In the coming week, the funeral for George Floyd, whose death in police custody triggered massive U.S. protests against racism, is held in Houston. The novel coronavirus continues its global spread 6 months after emerging from Wuhan. And the fourth round of Brexit talks between the U.K. and the European Union are held. It's June 4th, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, we're going to kick off with the story that's been certainly dominating U.S. headlines for the past 5 days, but also increasingly global headlines, and that is the protests happening across the country and increasingly in world capitals that have been sparked by the video footage showing the death of a 46-year-old black man named George Floyd in the custody of Minneapolis police, in particular police officer Derek Chauvin. These protests have led to citywide curfews. National Guard has been called out in some larger cities. Washington, D.C. has multiple forces being deployed. There's photos of them spreading around the city and the country. But Jim, can you tell us more about what's been going on and what we should be looking to ahead in these protests, both domestically and internationally?
Certainly, Bob. I would say that the United States right now is at a singular moment. I can't think of anything quite analogous to what we're witnessing in my lifetime. The protests have broken out. They have been largely peaceful, but not always. There have been people who've tried to make mayhem during the protest, but I think overwhelmingly they have been peaceful. And what's remarkable is how diverse the protesters are. And I think they are trying to send a message that there is something systemically wrong with the country, and it is time that the United States confront its problems and acknowledge them and take action. And I think that's incredibly laudable. I will note, as you mentioned, that what has happened here in the United States has triggered protests around the world. Paris, London, Amsterdam, among other places, protests have broken out. Partly that's people wanting to lend their support and solidarity with Americans, but also highlighting problems that many of these countries have themselves with racism and the feeling that not all citizens are equal, that they do not live in countries in which law and order is dispassionate dispensed. And, you know, if you look at it coming back to the United States, I think our reaction to the protests sort of exposes the deep divisions in this country and I think exposed the limitations of the current administration. We've talked before on the podcast about the administration's bungled handling of the coronavirus. And really, right now, we're being hit with three crises: coronavirus, the economic downturn, and now these protests over police brutality.
Well, and each of those, you know, reflecting disproportionate impact on minorities, on blacks and other minorities in the country as well.
Certainly the case. And, you know, what's remarkable and I think disturbing has been the president's response, which has not been to try to bring the country together, not to acknowledge the pain that many Americans, not just black Americans or not just people of color, but many Americans feel, actually a majority of Americans feel about what they're seeing on their TV screens, but rather to emphasize his notions of strength and power and domination. I mean, the president's comments to the governors are telling, calling them jerks if they did not seek to dominate their opponents. And of course, we had what happened on Monday, where a variety of federal officers fired pepper spray and rubber bullets to disperse peaceful protesters outside the White House. Now, I live in Washington, D.C. I take my usual late afternoon walk, and I had gone down to Lafayette Square Park. There were a number of people milling around. There was nothing untoward happening. Walked back to my house about 30 minutes later, turned on the TV, and saw that the protesters were being dispersed without warning so that the president could make the walk across Lafayette Square Park to stand at St. John's Episcopal Church. And I think it was an incredibly disturbing moment. And I will note, it is a moment that has triggered incredible backlash. And then yesterday, we had the remarkable moment in which former Secretary of Defense James Mattis released a letter excoriating President Trump's handling of the domestic unrest that has been triggered by the killing of George Floyd. And let me just read a sentence or two from what Secretary Mattis wrote, because I can't think of anything like it in my lifetime from a four-star military officer, former cabinet member. And Mattis writes, and I quote him here, "Donald Trump is the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unite the American people, does not even pretend to try. Indeed, he tries to divide us." It was a similar letter a few days earlier from Mike Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who again laid into President Trump's actions, particularly his decision to have members of the National Guard and other federal federal officers forcibly clear a path through Lafayette Square Park. It is a reaction that I have sort of never seen in American politics before, and I think it really lays bare the very deep divisions we're seeing in the country. And again, to go back to where I opened, points to how right now is a signal moment that could have, I think, consequences on American democracy for a very long time.
Yeah, and it's interesting then, first of all, to add to that the ongoing calls by acting military leaders in the country, speaking out against racism in support of citizens' rights, in support of the Constitution, and how that will play against the administration's wishes to clearly demonstrate a law and order approach and to use the military in that end. And then you also have in the New York Times a much talked about op-ed by Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas titled, Send in the Troops. It was noted in many places that this edition came out the day of marking the 31st anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, where the Chinese government sent in troops to quash protests back in 1989, sort of further calling into question U.S. credibility as a rights champion. And that's something that's going to continue to get a lot of attention now. Again, it is a wrenching domestic moment, but also the world looks to the U.S. in all sorts of ways. And it's very interesting to see both the criticism of U.S. leadership, but also what you're seeing in some of these protests around capitals around the world, solidarity with U.S. protesters. It's fascinating to watch. It's scary, a bit unnerving, obviously, but hopefully a moment of change and movement in the right direction.
Well, you're certainly right, Bob. And I will note, you know, one immediate concern is having to do with the impact this is going to have on civil-military relations. The United States takes great pride, for good reason, in having a non-political military. And I think one of the fears that motivated Secretary Mattis, Admiral Mullen, and actually a variety of other former senior military leaders is that the military will become politicized. But there's also that important point, Bob, that this very much hurts America's standing in the world, seeing sort of an administration which has disdain for people exercising the freedoms that the United States champion. It's very clear that if you look to Beijing or Moscow, they're quite happy to see the United States tear itself apart. I mean, the Twitter feed from a variety of Chinese officials drives that point home, likening what President Trump has done and encouraged, and things like Senator Cotton have encouraged, to what has been done in Hong Kong. So I think this is really sort of damaging America's soft power that we often talk about. And again, that goes hand in hand with what we've talked about before. The bungled handling of the coronavirus pandemic has really sent signals to the world, leading people to doubt America's basic competence to get things done. I think this is, again, just a deeply, deeply troubling time.
And we, you know, finally, it's worth noting yet again, this is all playing out in an election year. Everybody is well aware that. You've had probably the most outspoken person on the Democratic side being presumptive candidate Joe Biden, who has been making comments about this and is seemingly gearing up to make further comments about how he would aim to restore and transform the U.S. So the president himself has made clear what the stakes are as well, and some of his supporters are rallying behind him. But there's also seems to be a great deal of unease among some of the former supporters of the president.
Well, I'll note, Bob, you mentioned, you know, leading Democrats have jumped on this issue. Former Vice President Joe Biden has spoken out, as you noted. What's remarkable is how little we have heard from many Senate Republicans, particularly in response to what happened in Lafayette Square Park earlier this week. As you know, a number of journalists have tried to get senators to go on record to comment as whether they thought it was appropriate for the police to be used to clear out protesters so the president could stand in front of St. John's Episcopal Church. And what has been remarkable has been the extent of the silence among Republican senators.
It's also worth noting that in the midst of all this, there were some elections that took place and some interesting results playing out, including the loss in the Iowa primary by Congressman Steve King, who was drawn a lot of controversy for racially tinged remarks, as well as on the more local level, another past flashpoint on racial issues is the town of Ferguson, Missouri, where a Black woman was for the first time elected mayor. So interesting things playing out across the country, Jim. And I think this podcast and other foreign policy focused sites might be coming back again to the U.S. more than they would have in the past.
These are obviously big issues, Bob, that we're not going to be able to explore in all of the depth that they merit, but I'd like to sort of switch gears right now and talk about the coronavirus. We are now several months into the pandemic. We've talked about the topic a lot in the podcast, but then again, it is a global issue and it touches on almost everything else we can discuss here. Can you give us an update of where things are at, Bob?
Sure, Jim. Yeah, so I think we recently passed the official sort of 6-month mark from when it was sort of formally announced that this pandemic had emerged from Wuhan, China. And as it pathed its way from Asia, it jumped to Europe and certain spots like Iran and Italy pretty quickly. But you've seen this progression across the world. And then you've seen some places more than others, you've seen it, the virus subside. And in the vast majority of those cases, it's because of very firm early efforts by governments, whether it's South Korea, Taiwan, Germany, to do a combination of things, which is, you know, the lockdown, to social distancing measures, to test, vigorous testing, what they call contact tracing, and to basically provide a sense of the path of this virus and get an understanding of it right at the outset so that they can put the measures in place where they need to be put in place. The U.S. was involved in a lot of guesswork. It's also devolved into a kind of a state-run enterprise. So it, among other reasons, the U.S. was the site of one of the worst outbreaks, but the U.S. curve is flattening, which is a term we haven't heard in a while, but that curve is flattening as well. It is not flattening in Latin America, which is said to be the epicenter now. The U.S. has recorded the most deaths, 107,000 or so at this point, Jim. Globally, it's about a little bit less than, I think, a third of the global number of deaths, 1.7 million cases in the U.S. But you're seeing these, again, going back to graphics, you're seeing these really alarming graphics in places like Brazil, Mexico, Peru. Latin America is being hit hard, and there's a variety of reasons for that. They saw it coming. They certainly had ample warning, but they also have had existing problems with, you name it, infrastructure, health infrastructure, or poverty, and particularly on the latter front, the inability to distance people, for people to live in distance, whether it's the favelas, the slums of Brazilian cities, or in some other locales in Latin America. The efforts that had succeeded in other places wasn't working in Latin America. And Latin America, we should note, was fairly effective in its response to the Zika virus of several years ago. So they have had a record of responding successfully to a health threat. But this one, the infection rate is so rampant on this one, and the challenges it posed to healthcare systems. I mean, we saw it. It wasn't too long ago that we saw like New York City under siege, really, and just incredible strain on the health infrastructure of a major U.S. city. But the U.S. is, like a lot of Western and developed countries, had the ability to ramp up resources and over time to bring to bear the healthcare equipment to protect healthcare workers, the wherewithal of people to sort of produce masks and all sorts of other equipment to help tamp down the spread. We're not through it in the U.S. either. If you look at a chart of U.S. states, there's a few places where it's still spiking alarmingly. I think Texas and Arizona are two states where there's a lot of concern. Oregon recently popped up. A lot of health experts have warned of the second wave of this, hearkening back to the 1918 pandemic, where the second wave was more deadly than the first. So at the same time, Jim, I don't know about you in D.C., but in Northern Virginia, I think there's a great deal of feeling of people wanting to just get out and sort of free themselves from the bounds of the lockdown and sort of resume some sense of normalcy. And you can see it in some of the slackening of some of the restrictions that had been placed in some public areas. And that's following a governor's move from what they call phase zero to phase one. I think they're going to move a lot of the state of Virginia to phase two soon. That means more and more services can be opened and other restrictions slackened. Outdoor cafes are now proliferating where restaurants had been shut completely before. So certainly in some parts of the world, an easing. I should also note in Europe, you actually have Italy, one of the worst hit European countries, opening its borders soon to tourists from Europe, within Europe, Germany looking to do the same. And yet, you know, there is this fear wherever this virus is rampant, you know, it doesn't know any boundaries and can keep jumping borders all too soon again. So we're in a weird spot right now, Jim, where it's existing, but it's kind of run its initial course in the U.S. and many parts of the U.S.
Well, let me ask you about that, Bob, because there's been a lot of talk, particularly in conservative media circles, over the fact that we're having these protests, that people are not necessarily keeping the 6-foot social distancing. I will say a number of the protests I've watched or been to, many people are wearing their masks. I don't know to what extent being outdoors increases your or decreases your chance of being exposed. But what is your sense? Are we likely to see sort of a boomlet of cases in metropolitan places where people are protesting?
I think that's the big question, Jim, because of, as you say, the close proximity of all these people and really the protests, the impetus for the protests outrunning the concern of, but also also, I think in response to the lockdown a little bit, it was sort of been a catharsis in some ways that these protests yielded. But it's a question of whether or not there was too many people not wearing masks, whether things like, I've seen reports that people whose lungs might have been damaged even temporarily by tear gas are then more susceptible to mm-hmm. The ravages of the virus. That's another concern. At the same time, there's people are wondering whether there continues to be reporting that warmer weather does seem to tamp down, or exposure to sunlight or what have you, does seem to tamp down the virus a little bit. I think there's a bit of clenching going on right now, waiting to see what happens. And certainly of more concern is that with the shackles off and in some of the warmer climates in the U.S., you're seeing images of crowded beaches and the Lake of the Ozarks, for example, and places like that, where there are people not wearing masks and close together enjoying themselves, but maybe hatching a new set of problems down the road. So again, it's tough, and it continues to be increasingly tough in the U.S. because you're hearing a multiplicity of voices about what to do about it. You still have a CDC that's kind of under fire and not seem to be in command of the messaging on this. The White House is now sort of inconsistently messaging on the health requirements involved. You're getting the state houses are really taking the reins seemingly in what they're doing, but they're supposed to be guided in part by some of the federal guidelines. And then you have the race for the vaccine. That's definitely going on. You have some major efforts.
Well, tell me
US
about that,
China.
Bob, because I saw an interview with Anthony Fauci where he talked about how by January 2021 we could have 100 million doses of the vaccine. And then I noticed when you read the details, there was no guarantee the vaccine would work. But is it reasonable to be optimistic about a vaccine, or is the jury still out on that?
It's tough because people want to be optimistic, if that makes any sense. But there is sobering, clear-eyed guidance out there from the health community. And I mentioned the credible voices. It's important to kind of read the main credible media, the vetted medical media. There's a service called STAT that I think has become a must-read service. The Johns Hopkins site that everybody is citing is really important. And the Think Global Health site that CFR has launched a few months ago has also had a lot of important writing on this. But I think when you talk to vaccine experts and you read about the process, it's undeniable that there is a time that's needed to do human trials. It's just undeniable. You have to test and see whether or not this actually has an impact on humans or not. And as important, not to have side effects that could cause, lasting problems of another sort. And to do that all takes time. At the same time, there has been incredible progress in healthcare and in, let's say, gene therapy and other things. There's been progress in ways we're already seeing, guardedly progress in treatments. So ahead of a vaccine, just treatments to mitigate the impact of the virus and health experts learning about the way this virus acts and the way you can effectively combat it. So there's a bunch of things like that. But I think January 2021 still seems optimistic by the accounts I've read.
Yeah. Again, I think for a lot of this, we need to always sort of do the caveat of saying there's a lot no one knows, even right. The experts.
That's right, Jim. And let's take another topic that no one seems to know a lot about, and that is Brexit, which used to be a lot more front burner than it has been of late. But the Brexit process is underway. I talked last week on the podcast with our colleague Sebastian Mallaby about EU's coronavirus rescue plan and how extraordinary that process has been and how much of a game changer it could be for the EU going forward. But I'd like to talk a bit more about the UK-EU talks that are going on right now. Can you give us a sense of where things stand on this front? And is Brexit going to happen in this calendar year, for example?
Certainly, Bob, though I have to say that talking about Brexit in the aftermath of the two big issues we talked about makes the Brexit issue seem a lot smaller, though obviously important to the EU and to the United Kingdom. Let's sort of establish a couple of things. One, Brexit has begun. That is, the United Kingdom informed the EU at the beginning of the year it was departing. Now what they're doing is negotiating the terms of the divorce, and the Brits have made it clear they want to have this done by December 31st of this year. His negotiating position, let me underline negotiating position, is that he's not going to agree to an extension of this so-called transition period. And if you don't get a deal, then you have a so-called hard Brexit, which would be economically tumultuous for both sides of the English Channel. And here's the key thing to keep in mind. Under the rules, if the United Kingdom does want an extension of this transition period, it has to do so by July 1. So you're talking just short of 4 weeks from right now. That's the background to what's happening. Now, the negotiations picked up again on Tuesday. They're supposed to run through tomorrow. There was talk that the Brits were going to potentially walk out if the EU didn't give them what they wanted. wanted. And I'll note, just as we sat down, I got a bulletin saying that Prime Minister Boris Johnson has agreed to meet with the head of the European Union sometime in June. I'm not sure exactly where or when in June this is going to take place. So obviously, the negotiations are going forward. And the big question again is, under what terms will the EU be separated from England or from the United Kingdom or vice versa? And that's what they're dealing with right now.
Are you seeing any sort of change or shift in the posture of the UK? And I'm thinking partly because after Boris Johnson himself was hospitalized with coronavirus, he had very gracious things to say about the healthcare workers who helped him, and many of whom were immigrants. And immigration is a big backdrop to the driving Brexit forces in the UK. He's also made an extraordinary gesture towards citizens of Hong Kong, that I think up to 3 million of them he's offered the chance to come and live in the UK. Those seem to be a marked change from some of the positioning we saw coming out of the Johnson government. But maybe I'm reading too much into it.
I haven't seen any indication that Boris Johnson has changed the main demands the Brits are making in these divorce talks with the EU. What the United Kingdom wants is tariff-free trade with the European Union. And the European Union says, we're not going to agree to that unless you agree to a level playing field. That means having common regulations in place. You're trying to avoid what economists refer to as regulatory arbitrage. That is, setting up a business in the United Kingdom where potentially regulations are less onerous and then exporting into the EU. And then, of course, there's this issue we've talked about before, which is really small in economic terms, but which is really big in political terms, and that is fisheries and access to fisheries. And this is a big thing. And again, it's big, not because of its economic consequences, but British fishermen, particularly English fishermen, are very well organized in demanding that their rights be protected. And the same thing is true across the channel, particularly, I think, with French fishermen. So these are the big issues. And I've said this many times in the podcast. So for our longtime listeners, I beg their pardon for repeating myself. The general way negotiations go is nobody walks away from their big demands until the last moment. And that's when you find out, you know, which of the demands are non-negotiable. And I think we have a ways to go on that. And so this will play out like the exit from the EU formally took quite a long time to go, with lots of supposed heart-stopping moments that turn out not to be heart-stopping.
Fair enough.
Bob, this is the time of the podcast. We do our figures of the week. Who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a number. It is 14,000, as in 14,000 feet. That's the height at which we had an unusual eruption in fist fighting between soldiers from both China and India recently. And the tensions have not subsided that much, according to a number of reports. So this gets at the disputed border and area of tension that persists high in the Himalayas between India and China. They have a huge border, and there are points at which there remain disputes between China and India. They fought a war over it back in the 60s. There are agreements not to exchange hot fire, and they seem to have resisted on that. But there are a number of troops who've come into the recent areas of tensions, and it's raising a lot of concern. Now, they're supposed to have meetings, I believe, this coming weekend to try to diffuse the situation. But a lot of observers say these are the most serious confrontations between China and India since 2017. And there could be more tensions and more buildup before this subsides, Jim.
Bob, do we know what the root of this recent flare-up in tensions between the two countries is?
From what I understand, it is an incredibly complicated series of issues that divides the two sides, but there appears to be road building going on in this region. And this is a region that runs up against Kashmir, disputed Kashmir, and there's road building going on that each side say violates their agreements that they've reached concerning pacifying and dealing with their dispute in a peaceful way and in a non-provocative way. And so, you know, I think anytime you have infrastructure being built, it's, you know, the one side accuses the other of kind of creating facts on the ground and speaking of negotiations, as we were previously. And so I think that might be what is most at issue here. But again, it raises concerns that it spilled over into actual brawling. And again, at 14,000 feet, the idea of people kind of going at it, you know, armies going at it from the two most populous countries in the world is kind of staggering.
Both of which are nuclear armed, I should point out.
Yes, yes. Not to be forgotten. And by the way, there was a gesture, I think, by President Trump to sort of help mediate, and that was rebuffed by the Indians. I'm not sure if the Chinese responded, actually, but the Indians did.
The chances that either country would have accepted that offer were below zero.
Well, Jim, who or what is your figure of the week?
I have a figure week, Bob, but before I get to it, I want to share some breaking news because I had said earlier in the podcast that Senate Republicans had been quiet in terms of criticisms of President Trump's handling of protests about George Floyd and particularly what transpired on Monday at Lafayette Square Park. And it just popped up in my news feed that Lisa Murkowski, Republican senator from the state of Alaska, called Secretary of Defense or former Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis's rebuke of President Trump, quote, necessary and overdue. She went on to say, quote, I felt like we're perhaps getting to the point where we can be more honest with the concerns that we might hold internally and have the courage of our own convictions to speak up. So I just wanted to flag that since this is obviously a fluid story and it even changed since we began the podcast. But the person I wanted to make as a figure of the week is a bit of good news, and it's a gentleman named Michael White. He's a U.S. Navy veteran who has been held captive in Iran for something on the order of 660 days. And as of today, as of right now as you speak, he is flying back to the United States, courtesy of the Swiss government, which acts as a go-between between the United States and Iran. He has been released. This comes on the heel of the Trump administration on Tuesday releasing an Iranian, I believe, scientist and returning him to Iran.
Jim, sometimes return of detainees can be seen as a softening gesture or confidence building, as one of the terms in diplomatic parlance. Any signs or signals that this is in any way something that could be an area of continued cooperation between the United States and Iran?
It possibly could be, Bob, but I would not make any significant wager on that front. Again, the Trump administration has been quite emphatic that it intends to continue its maximum pressure strategy. No backing down. The argument is that they're inflicting tremendous pain on the Iranian economy, which they are. And their hope is that this will lead the Iranian mullahs to make concessions in terms of the nuclear program and Iran's broader behavior in the region. There's no sign that the mullahs are about to do that. I mean, another possibility here is that certainly for the Iranians, it's best for them to return Michael White. He's a cancer patient. He had contracted the novel coronavirus. Now that he leaves, they're no longer responsible for his health considerations. I believe that the Iranians still hold another American citizen hostage. So I wouldn't suggest this indicates in any way, shape, or form that the Iranian government has suddenly adopted humanitarianism as its policy.
Got it. Meanwhile, terrific to hear about Michael White. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg is set to speak on the future of NATO next week. And WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange resumes his hearing on extradition from the UK via video.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Anna Graitzer, Noah Mulligan, and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. Zoe Collis also served as our recording engineer this week. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music was provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long, and stay tuned for next week's special summer entertainment podcast.